Possibly.
Can you make a call?
Yeah.
I will check.
Okay, thanks. Is this, I mean, is the rest of the too?
Yeah.
That we're interested in a situation where we have a global symmetry. If in any theory like that, let's look at the effective field theory below the symmetry Bacon scale, there will always be, in the low energy theory, these goals are put down. So these things will always be in the low energy theory, and so one question is, how did they appear? And what can you say about their properties? And the message of this formalism that I'm describing is that if you know the symmetry you break attack, then you know a lot about how the Goldstone bosons couple. And the short version of the rule, so if you ask kind of what's the low energy theory, and what does it know about the symmetries that were in the full theory, it's the symmetry of the full theory of G. The answer is going to turn out to be that in the low energy theory, the Lagrangian you write down is constrained by H invariance, so the unbroken symmetry, that's not surprising. But it knows about G invariance, and it knows about G invariance because that tells you how that dictates how the Goldstone bosons are coupled. So if you take a kind of a generic H invariant Lagrangian involving all the other fields in the theory besides the Goldstone bosons, you can make it for free G invariant. By coupling the Goldstone bosons properly, and the lesson of the Goldstone boson Lagrangian we're going to get is the rule that tells you how to do this. And so that means that if you're looking to ask what's the low energy residual information due to a symmetry breaking pattern like this, the answer is the constraints on your Lagrangian, the kinds of interactions you're allowed to write down, are all coming from the unbroken symmetry group, so they don't know about the rest of G. But the coupling of the Goldstone bosons is where the information about the extra G invariance is. That's in the low energy theory to tell you that the high energy theory had this extra symmetry program, even though you spontaneously broke them. And if you were to gauge the symmetry, then you know in the full theory what's going to happen is that the Goldstone bosons will get eaten by the H bosons, and then they'll both get a mass. So it can be true that depending on how big the couplings are, that the gauge bosons are among the things you integrate over to get your effective theory. And then, in that case, the suspicion you should have is that you've removed the Goldstone bosons, and so then you're left with a statement that you look at the Lagrangian energy is just constrained by the unbroken group H, and it doesn't actually know it. There's nothing, there's no more longer any evidence that G was in unbroken symmetry at higher scales. So that's basically also true. So if you're well below the scale at which a G symmetry breaks, the Lagrangian in general doesn't need to know about the fact that he broke the that the symmetry G was there. As for a global symmetry, you do know, because the Holmes bosons are there to tell the low energy theory that the symmetry, that there was a symmetry in the full field. So the question is, what's the, what we want to know is how these Goldstone bosons couple, to what extent can you dictate their couplings from the symmetries, and the upshot will be that if you do a derivative expansion, there's several issues. There's the issues of how the Goldstone bosons couple to the other interaction, other fields of the problem, and that's something which may or may not be simple depending on what those fields are. There's also the issue of how the Goldstone bosons couple to one another. And that's dictated by the symmetry group, largely up to a couple constants, and at the two derivative level, there's nothing at the no derivative level because Goldstone bosons won't be in potential at all. And at the two derivative level, you'll see that it's more or less uniquely determined. And that was implicit in the story we had about power dependent for pi at 30. So that's kind of where I'm going now, is I want to derive the how you make invariant Lagrangians for these Goldstone bosons, and I want to do that using the transformation rules that we got last time. So in last class, we used the Alan Coleman Wesson Zamino claim is that there's no loss of generality. So the notation we were using was that we take the generators of the group, so G is being the exponential of e to the I omega alpha t alpha, or omega k t a. Then the generators of H will call e to the I omega I t I. So capital T with a lowercase first letters of the alphabet index will be the whole group. Things in the middle of the alphabet will be the ungrowth group, the lowercase generator T. And things in G over H will be things in EGI and the alpha X alpha. So with that notation, what we're thinking is that there's going to be a field very one of these axes, because these are the ones that break the symmetry. So we're imagining there's an expectation value in the full theory, there's an expectation value in the vacuum to non-zero for which x acting on b is not zero, whereas t acting on b is zero. I'm going to use that. And remember, I'm also using that, I'm going to use the fact that we can just choose this to be a real five-dimensional orthogonal representation. So, no, so phi would be some representation of G, some collection of fields, and they got they're not zero, they're at the minimum potential. So they were spontaneous breaking. So this will be some subset. It'll live in some representation, but it won't span the whole representation. So for the Higgs field, for instance, it would be just the bottom real one.
This value.
Yeah. Okay. And this choice here implicitly is limiting what G could be, because there's not all groups have five-dimensional. those are restricting us to the compact groups, but those are all the ones that you would have for internal symmetries, like the auto groups, the inherent groups, like the groups and the exceptional groups. But it won't, if you're interested in space-time transformations, say, or things that are not compact, then you might have to rethink some of the steps I'm going to do. And some, depending on the example you're thinking about, rethinking may be more complicated. Or not, if it depends on the application. But I'm going to use this because it's quite general, but it's sufficient. So the transformation rule that we were using was I'm trying to finish off here the following standard transformation bosons. So this is all preamble. The transformation rule is this is what the last class was about, which was motivating this choice. So we take the fields we're interested in live in G over H. So we define, we're trying to find theta alpha. These are the fields that describe the Goldman bosons. And we want, there'll be some rule which will be, we'll take them to theta twiddle alpha. X. And that rule will depend on the original theta of X, and it will depend on some group transformation. And so I have to tell you what this rule is, and that was the last thing we ended up with. So the idea is that if I take the matrix e to the I theta alpha square, e to the I theta alpha X, take that matrix, and I multiply it by G, the transformation that we're trying to ask. We're asking, how does this field transform under any element G inside the group G? So G is just the constant matrix, whereas these thetas are field-dependent. So this is a field-dependent matrix, a position-dependent matrix. As I mentioned, it's because of the field dependence here. Whereas this is just a constant G. And that's some guy living inside G again, because this was living inside G. So I can almost decompose that into something which is living in the coset G over H times something which is living in H. So that in that decomposition, the thing living in the coset is what I'm calling the theta twiddle here. And the thing that lives in H is what I'll call EBI U. That UI will depend on X. It'll depend on theta and on theta twiddle in general. G. And that makes in particular it's also a function of X. The idea is we're decomposing something in G over H or something in H.
Good.
Yeah.
So decomposition in a unique job?
Yes. we were doing like some globalist control. Locally is unique, and so the you're really good about things like topological things.
I don't really see why it should be locally, how you can prove that. I mean for abelian groups it's clear, but
not really was it. The way I think about it is a way of deriving it. First thing, where did this transformation rule come from? It was coming from this taking the, if you took this field phi, you've got this bev, and rewarded as being a group transformation times backing. And it was basically the same, we're defining the Goldstone bosons to be the things that are in the group transformation that came back in. That only suits the x's, because otherwise it's just the and then the chi's are whatever's left. And more or less, if you ask how those two things transform under the symmetry, given that phi goes to g times phi, that's the rule for the group transformation is this. The rule for the, what was the modulus, is that it transforms into itself times t to the I u times t. So right this back in. And so the uniqueness of this is the same as the uniqueness of that decomposition of the fields. Which you asked about that too when we talked about that. And I argued last class that you can always get to from any field configuration of 5x, you can get to a configuration which is where you had to say say that the analog of the modulus variable is satisfying, it was orthogonal to the Boltzmann direction. So that satisfying condition, like I transpose x to b equals 0. And that's the statement that you can get there with based on the statement that if you built the combination, you made the thing. I can remember the next year. I can't make this. Then if I do a transformation statement, the solutions that would take you to the decomposition that water over there were the ones that were stationed. I thought of this as a transformation, or this is being pi as being u plus pi. I think this makes sense for the angles. Then the angle, this being stationary was the condition that pi had to satisfy that was orthogonal. And you knew that those things existed because it was a bounded function and a real bounded function. So I guess the uniqueness then would be it's true that you're not just giving them back to get back to the end. And this condition wasn't really relying on you being able to. So it might be a discrete choice. But it's so that's the local statement would be that in the neighborhood of so if you take this function which has got some level, it's got max and minima, once you're in the vicinity of one of those things, then it's unique. There might be discrete. So I don't know if they're not discrete. That's the state stuff. Yeah.
Is there these generators, are they all
in the that's part of the definition.
So why isn't that statement just trivial then?
Which one?
You multiply the decomposition. You can take the group and exponentiate it. So just the sum of the generators is just a product.
But the product, because it's not abelian, the product of the EVI theta x times the EVI ut is not EVI theta x plus ut. Because there's the failure to abelian, there's somebody's theorem that says that the difference involves commutators. Because it's not this is not saying that I can write theta twiddle is equal to theta plus some function of g or something. The are not trivial anyhow, it's not linear relationship. Which I'll make more explicit in a second so you can see. I'll do the infinitesimal transformation is easier to think about, so I'll write that one down more explicitly.
Why are you exponentiating this Boltzmann term?
Because I'm associating the field with the generator in the Lie algebra. And so these matrices, G was in the group, and so I wanted to write the action originally of the. And the thing this was coming from was I took the field phi, and Bev was giving it the breaking symmetry. And running it as being somebody in the group, depending on theta, a position-dependent rotation in the group, and some normalization of the analog of the statement. If we'd been doing the E1 theory, we said phi was equal to EVI theta times pi, where pi was real. And this was the Boltzmann field, and this was the modulus. So this is the non-abelian generalization of that. This is some important thing, and this is the matrix. And then what I wanted to do was the thing that was playing the role of the field was really the Lagrangian thing that looked normal was the thing that looking at the variable that shifts under the symmetry, that's the thing that's really distinctive what goes on. And that's typically the associated with the generator of the group rather than the group element response. So when I do the infinitesimal transformations, it'll be useful to get the terms of the algebra. So, So let me kind of come back to you about the uniqueness of this, because this looks like it's not Artemis. I guess this doesn't mean that it's not unique. This means that there could be many ways to, more than one way of extracting a field phi, which transforms in this way. But my gut feeling is that it is unique. And I think the missing step is something which I'm not going to be able to do in my head, but it's coming down to and the way you derive that. I probably didn't do that explicitly last time. But it was I think this is unique, but I'm not sure. I might have told you, I'll have to go back and read it. That'd be great for work. All right. So it's a transformation rule, and to make it more explicit, I told you last class there was a special case. If G happened to be living in H, so let's call it, in that case, let's call it living H. Then, as an explicit solution, there's an explicit solution to this decomposition, which is explicitly linear in the transformation. So, let me label this equation. Let's start. And the solution to star is we get e to the I u, which is t, and then just take e to the h. That's what we'll take. And we'll take e to the I theta twiddle alpha x alpha, and we'll write that as being h inverse h the I theta alpha x alpha h inverse. That's the coset, and this is also the coset. So this solves that problem, and it's explicitly something which is linear in the linear transformation. It's in the adjoint, basically, of this group H. And this shows you that I is just transforming. For this matrix H, that you can do what you do. If we're just talking about this subgroup H. So, transformation in alpha. See, that's not how it was. So I write this as being API inverse. So I can imagine writing this out as a series. All the H inverses to each other opposite the one on the outside. In this particular case, the distinction between a representation and a realization of a group is that the representation is a linear transformation. So for this case, where you're doing a transformation that's in the subgroup that was not broken, this is just a representation. This is a transformation like one you would have chosen. You would have felt free to choose for fields anyway. So these fields are transforming the very specific representation or in the adjoint representation of the group. So the boson goes on. Thank you.
When you watch those H's, the exponential, the inverse and the H kind of switch sides. Is that something for that, or is that just...
No, that was just game games.
To answer the question that he answered earlier, posed earlier on, shouldn't H be a normal subgroup anyways? Because otherwise, G over H is not a group. And so, in which case, if H is a normal subgroup, then
all right.
So it is unique.
Well, if H is a normal subgroup, I'm guessing that H should be a normal subgroup. I'm guessing you want G over H to be a group.
Yeah.
No, it doesn't have to be.
It doesn't have to be.
No.
Yeah.
So, for example, this could be a two spheres. It's just the PSS three divided by one. And then the other two generate a kind of group. And the special case where it is a group is a. I forget what that's called. It's a, but that's kind of like something. All right. So in a case that you're looking at somebody who's not broken, it's a garden variety transformation, and then the interesting transformation will be the one that broke the trees, and that's the one where I want to show you that it's both nonlinear and inhomogeneous. And the inhomogeneous is the signature of the both of those. Inhomogeneous in the sense that there's a shift going on.
Or
the array specialized to this I forgot to tell you. So I'm gonna use that it's basically generators. Which trace of TA. Particular, that means it's a trace of, X alpha, beta, simple delta alpha beta, trace of Ti, Tj, delta j, trace of Ti, x alpha, 0. And I can always choose a basis like that, because I'm always creating a linear combination of the generators, and then I can choose a linear combination that diagonalizes this matrix. Scale away at diagonal elements. So implicit in that assumption is that the diagonal elements are positive. I don't have a negative eigenvalue there. I didn't put a minus sign in here. And that's relying on the positive definiteness of this, which is true for the compact groups. And I didn't show that to you because to reboot on that, I have to remember how to prove that, but it's that this is always possible. This is the UNs and the ONs, the ESPNs, and the so if you had a group like SU21 or something like that, then some of these things would have negative signs, and you could just get one. And the groups I'm talking about are going to take that choice. So if I just use the definitions, then I give you an explicit formula for what these deltas are. So the delta, so if I just do a Taylor expansion here at powers of theta, you can see that because if I just expand it in power series and theta, see that the first term here where I take a 1 to both sides is going to survive because I'm going to trace it to an x's. So that's going to start off being delta alpha beta times omega beta. And the next thing that will survive will be something involving the trace of three things with an omega. So I'll have a trace of x alpha, x beta, happening is that, remember, so this variable is really the first correction to both the boson transformation rule. This variable is going to similarly start off, right, if I look at the piece where I take one on both sides here, I have a trace of t times x to zero because of this thing over here. So the first thing I'm going to get is when I have bring down at least one more x here, so I'll have this dropping trace of ti beta x gamma minus ti gamma beta. That's a vector by iron
here. In the first line, didn't you note the tilde on the last position?
No.
In the exponential?
No, I didn't. No, because what I've done here is that I've taken the theta tilde and I've filled it as theta, the theta plus correction, which is a bunch of theta 2, so everything's a bunch of theta 1. And I plug that into the definition of the transformation rule. So everything that's occurring is always a theta. Doesn't that? That's where the delta came from. Is that I took the transformation rule, linearized the delta, for where I replaced the theta quiddle using this expression. And I want to read off now the transformation. So there's no theta quiddle left. Delta, if you like, is not exactly the same as, but it's close to the difference between theta quiddle.
Yes, I know you're not thinking of the difference.
Why not?
Because but I thought what you wanted to do was you take e to the exponential I theta tilde mu, you do e to the mu, multiply in front of that e to the minus I to get it.
And what I do is I basically take this transformation, I plug this definition of delta in,
good.
And then I multiply through by this inverse, that's for the minus theta to the minus delta. And then for g, I write it as an infinitesimal 1 plus omega t. And I start multiplying it by t and x, taking traces. So when I multiply by t, I take a trace and it goes away. And so I get in that way these two are free. But everything on the right hand side involves only theta because I've eliminated theta here using this expression before doing that. And then I solve for delta. So there's a bunch of steps that I did right there. But this is where it goes. So the main, all I'm really trying to show you here is that when we do a transformation that's in G and not in H, then what happens is that if I plugged in, I could if I wanted to, in fact I should probably do that.
You're saying that Goldstone bosons are in adjoint representation of H, but I think it should be G by H.
No, because the transfer of the symmetry I'm doing is this is made of G.
Yes.
So the transformation I'm asking what group am I representing, it's this thing. And that's already
H. But the number of Goldstone bosons are equal to the
they're in G over H, yeah.
Yes. So in adjoint representation you have the same number of the fields. The number of fields will be equal to the number of generators.
Yes, the proper statement here would be that it's in the adjoint representation of G, but it's specialized to H transformations in G. Right? You're thinking that the adjoint representation of H is some thing generators of loop in H. And you're saying the Goldstone bosons don't live in H. That's true. That's what your question is. Like, how can these things live in the adjoint representation of H if they're not actually in the algebra of H themselves? Because that's the adjoint representation of H is generated by the generators of H. Right? I'm trying to agree with your question. But you're still confused, so maybe I think you're asking.
So if you have like five Goldstone bosons.
Yeah.
So in adjoint representation, you should have the five generators under any complexes. Right. But it's not necessary that in H you have the five generators, and you won't be able to write in the adjoint representation.
Right. So that's what I was trying to play back to. So you're saying an explicit way of seeing that this thing, that these guys don't live in H, is that I'll take an example where the dimensions. Maybe I break H and there's nothing left. So I'm agreeing with you. So I'm saying this in a sloppy way. When I say it's in the adjoint representation, what it is, it's in the adjoint representation of G, and I take that and I decompose it under H, and then this is a piece of the adjoint representation of G, which is transforming under the H. It's not in the adjoint representation of H. Whatever.
Sorry, I want to come back to my original question. So, on the left hand side of this equation, you've got a delta. Right? On the right hand side, you've got nothing which contains delta. Yes, but you've got nothing which contains delta. Like,
well, this does. If I take this EVR beta twiddle and I plug this in for it, so I replace that by this whole thing,
yeah.
Then that was a delta.
I agree, but on the right. On the trace thing, there's no delta, there's no e to the I theta triddle, so it can't be right.
No, so there's a delta, you agree there's a delta here, and now I'm going to solve for
delta. I agree there's a delta in there.
And you
I think there's no delta in here.
I agree with that. There's no delta there? Huh. Where is it? Show me the delta.
Exactly. So how can delta be equal to something which has no delta?
Well, if I take this equation and I solve, do you agree I can solve it for delta? Yeah. Okay, this is the answer.
Okay. I don't get hungry.
There's some steps on that.
Okay.
That's what you need to do. But so I want to be logically clear. I'm not. I could sit down and we can work on the algebra.
But shouldn't
I'm
delta,
doing it
be a function of? Shouldn't delta be a function of theta and theta fiddle? It can't be a function of only the delta.
No, it's because a better way to think of this would be to say I could define theta fiddle minus theta to be c or something like that, and I could solve it for c. If I solve it for c, I've solved for c as a function of theta and the transformation parameter. And if I tell you what that is, I've told you what theta fiddle is as a function of theta and the transformation parameter. That's because I'm doing an intensive transformation. I know these things differ by a small amount. So I could have phrased it in terms of c, but the thing that's easier to work with these phrases is if I take this exponential and I rewrite it.
Okay.
But delta is kind of morally like c. And I can actually tell you what the transformation is between c and delta. But once I've done that, instead of solving for theta fiddle as a function of theta and g, what I should be doing is now solving for delta as a function of theta. Because that's really telling me something theta fiddle. And so that's the logic. So I put that in here, solve for delta. And I'll solve for it. I get rid of I identify the various generators independently using these traces. And that's how I'm going to get delta. I'll choose to multiply through by x, alpha, and then I'll trace over everything. And that'll be alpha. So that will become one of the homework problems. Because there's some steps that are worth going there, and I haven't done them. And it probably is, by this time it would have been faster for me to do them, but I'd have to reboot on them now, and so it won't be faster this time. But what I'm telling you is not it's not deep, it's just algebra from that line. Right. And the message is that when you do this, the transformation rule for these theta twiddles now, in fact, I'm going to tell you what C is. So C is... if I take that rule over there and I put it over here, then what C becomes is so many alpha. C alpha theta gamma theta gamma. Where these are the structure constants. Where right here. Similarly, I guess I might as well play with you. In terms of the structure classes, U is minus C pi. So the important thing is that you see that the theta variables are shifting under the symmetry because omega is a symmetry parameter, provided the transformation you're doing is in G over H. There's a shift, then there's a. So if we had been doing an abelian symmetry, that looked in the end of the story, and that would have been what we had for the U1, that we just had the phase shifted. But now we're picking up a piece to do with there being a non zero commutator amongst the generators of G. And it gets giving you a linear transformation. And this is the adjoint like transformation. This is the way a field in the adjoint transformation would have transformed. Group G, but there's also nonlinear corrections to it because that's just a nonlinear function of the theta. So that only we've only linearized the equations in omega to get this, and not in theta. But this is now linearizing in theta. So there's nonlinear terms that I haven't written, but which are there. So that's why it's called a nonlinear realization. Is that these transformations in general are nonlinear, but they're also inhomogeneous, which is the sign of there being a Goldstone boson. The sign of being a Goldstone boson because whatever value you thought the variable theta took in the vacuum, you know that the symmetry is going to move it to another value because you're shifting as part of your symmetry. So you've got a whole degenerate set of vacua being lit by this transformation, whatever it is, whatever your vacuum is for these. These U's are not inhomogeneously transformed depending on theta. Every omega is coming with a theta. So it starts off to do with the commutator of 2x is giving you a H. But it's also homogeneous. So the thetas are homogeneous and nonlinear, but the u's are not linear. And the u's you'll see are the transformation rules for self fields. So this useful exercise is to do this. You can do all this very explicitly for simple groups, like SU2 process, SU2 goes to SU2. So that was the process one that's there definitely not. So that would, maybe that's a good exercise to do as well. I'll put that together. So now the question is, how do you make invariant Lagrangians from this? And the answer is going to be relatively simple. So, what's this we look at? So in general, there's going to be two steps to this. So the low energy of gradient function, so function of the theta alphas at least, because those are the low order of. But there may other be other, there may also be other fields perhaps. All those stop. Now we know that H is a symmetry group for the low energy theory because H was not broken. So the low energy of Lagrangian must be H invariant. That means that these light fields have to transform into some representation of H, and they will inherit one from their transformation under G in the full theory. Psi transform. And we've seen that for H transformations, the theta is also transformed in a linear representation for H, the one that was on the previous board. So the making H invariants work is easy because it's just we're building invariants out of things that transform under merely under H. H is a global symmetry. So the rules are whatever the rules should have been if we had known anything with G. So what we want to know is how things transform under these guys that are not in H, that are in G. One way to think about that is supposing that we are making a Lagrangian built to the original, supposing our theory had originally been the theory of some scalar field phi, which got the expectation back. So it's an aside. We started with field phi, where the expectation of phi was B. Then it could be that the low energy theory, the field psi could have been the fields that I was calling chi before. Some of the others call it chi, okay. And the theta alphas are, when we write phi is equal to some transformation depending on theta times chi, with this condition v transpose x alpha chi when x is equal to 0, that splits the field into Wilson bosons and the non-Wilson bosons, and it may be that some of these things are light. So the size in this case, I probably should have kept them as a different variable, could include these guys. So in particular, we could ask, how do these guys transform? And you'll see that the that's going to be kind of clue as to how we want. You can make everybody transform in some way. Maybe night. But we know how they transform because phi transforms in this way. So that means that u, that's g times u with theta times chi. But our rule from the transformation was that this thing is equal to u of theta curl times e to the I u dot t times chi, which I can call u of theta twiddle, chi twiddle. And you can check that chi twiddle, defined this way, also satisfies this. So the transformation rule for these fields under H, or under G, transformation that got an H, is if this decomposition gives it to us. I transformation rule under G transformations I goes to my kernel, which is E to I G I. And remember, this lived in H. So that suggests that we should be able to choose our variables in such a way that since all these other fields, I'll call them psi. All these fields in low energy theory, whatever they are, they come to you with H transformation rules. We can give them a G transformation rule if we take the H transformation that they would transform under, which was a global thing, independent space-time, and replace it by this particular H transformation. And the only really concrete difference is that this parameter, because it's a function of these Goldstone-Boson fields, ends on space-time. So remember that ui is ui theta and g. Like, so because of that, in particular, it's a function of x. Because the x is inside theta. What we'll do is we'll choose size. So given that psi goes to e to the I omega I t I psi under h, what I'll do is I'll assign psi the g transformation property. And the program now will be making the current drive into this. Put in the rubber in current range. I was just thinking that this is a good time to have a break. And then we can have the, if you want to take part in whatever ceremonies are. I don't know how long it's going to last, but it's.
The ceremony should start till 11:11.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
So
yeah.
You can remember.
That was a... That's I guess against the spirit of it.
Somewhat. It's to pay tribute to all the people that fought in the wars. I think it was World War One.
Oh, but it originally from that, yeah.
Originally.
It's because the World War One ended on November 11th, 1918.
Oh.
At 11 o'clock. So it was the 11th hour, 11th day of the 11th month. And that's why they're celebrating it.
Canada joined in World War One.
Yeah.
Why? Is there any reason why? Because what was like World War?
Well, why was Canada involved?
Yeah.
In those days, it was actually Canada was automatically involved because the British were involved.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Oh, okay.
It was
an independent country, but in Canada, because there was not a war that made Canada independent. The process of independence came gradually, and so one of the things that came later was in World War II, it was not automatic that Canada was at war because Britain was at war. In World War I, it pretty much was automatic.
Yeah.
And it was because of World War I that it was no longer automatic than World War II.
Sounds good. Yeah, I don't think Canada is independent from the United Kingdom now. I mean, you have the Queen on
the Queen. Yeah. That's my theory. I have a theory about that. That's because Canada was founded by Scots. Scots are very frugal people.
Yeah.
So why would you pay for your own head of state when you can have the English pay for
it? I like it.